Section 7 of our Charter protects the right to life, liberty, and security of the person and not to be deprived of those rights except in accordance with the principles of fundamental justice. With respect to the first part of Section 7, the Supreme Court of Canada has recognized in a number of cases that healthcare has a profound impact on an individual's right to life, liberty, and security of the person. Section 7 protects the right of Canadians to refuse unwanted medical treatment and the right to make informed decisions regarding medical care for themselves and for their children. In order to actualize these rights and exercise informed consent, Canadians need access to high-quality, unbiased, evidence-based medical information. With respect to the second part of Section 7, both the government and public health are required to adhere to the principles of fundamental justice. At the individual level, to provide an opportunity for patients to participate in discussions about their own care. And at the policy and regulatory level, by ensuring that decisions are publicly debated before they are implemented. In the COVID context, what we've seen are doctors who are speaking about the state of public health care with respect to our treatment options, as well as with respect to the impact of the healthcare policies and the COVID measures that are taken. What these doctors are facing as a result of doing that is silencing by their colleagues, repercussions from their college, and stigmatization from the public. This is a serious threat to their right to Section 2B under the Charter, which is the right of freedom of expression and speech. The Constitutional Rights Center is concerned about the fact that in a healthcare crisis, the very voices that need to be heard, the doctors, the nurses, the frontline workers, are precisely the voices that are under threat and being silenced. Here to join me on this panel are three esteemed doctors who have bravely spoken about the reality on the ground of what they're experiencing, what they're seeing in their patient populations with the most vulnerable sectors, the same groups of people that COVID measures are allegedly intended to protect. Welcome to our show, and I'd like to have you begin by introducing yourselves. First, I'd like Dr. Lamba. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, please?
Sure. I'm a family physician. I work primarily in Brampton and Etobicoke. I do low-risk obstetrics as well as addiction medicine. I also am a long-term care physician, and I'm the executive director of a retirement home in Etobicoke, and I also have my own primary care practice in Brampton. Okay. And I've been working since 2014.
Thank you. And Dr. Phillips, we're joined by you too. Can you please give us a little background about your...
Yeah, so I'm a family doctor by training, but I've recently moved up to Englehart, Ontario, where I work primarily in the emergency department, but also do hospitalist medicine as well.
Okay, so Dr. Gill, please introduce yourself to us.
So I'm a frontline physician practicing in Brampton and also out in Milton. My training is in pediatrics and in allergy clinical immunology. I'm also the president and the co-founder of a frontline doctors group known as Concerned Ontario Doctors, and I've represented the interests of Canadian frontline doctors and also Canadian patients through advocacy efforts at committee testimonies at the Senate of Canada, at the House of Commons, and also here locally at the Queen's Park.
Excellent. So this panel is eminently qualified to speak about the issue of how COVID measures are impacting not just Canadians in general, but also the medical profession and the ability of professionals to be able to provide medical opinions on care and treatment. So I'd like you to start, Dr. Phillips, and tell us what was your initial reaction to the declaration of the COVID measures and the COVID pandemic?
So I'd say that my reaction to the original declaration of a pandemic back in March and April was probably similar to most physicians, and especially most physicians in Ontario's north. We were seeing what was going on in Wuhan, and then we saw what happened in northern Italy and then New York, and seeing bodies piling up. And I have to admit, I was pretty scared. Like, we knew so little about this virus at that time, and so our response was to prepare for disaster, and so we shut down a lot of our healthcare system in Ontario. Cancer screenings went out the window. We switched over to telemedicine, where a lot of doctors haven't seen their patients in quite a while. Yeah, we basically prepared for disaster in the beginning. It wasn't until probably heading into the second wave or maybe over the summer that I started to look into things, because COVID didn't really start to spread up north until that point. And when I did, I was kind of shocked that a lot of the talking points of the mainstream narrative didn't really fit with the research, like especially around vitamin D or the seasonality of the virus. And as I saw the research was piling up, I started to ask some questions that way. But that didn't really lead me to want to speak out on its own. I just wanted to kind of learn more about the virus. But it was what happened in the fall that really started to make me ask questions. And that was when I started to see this wave of patients who missed their cancer screenings during the first lockdown coming into me for the first time, just with belly pain or things like that. And I lay hands on them, either feeling a lump or put an ultrasound on them, and just find many patients just riddled with stage 4 cancer. And it was at that point that I realized we're doing something wrong here. Mm-hmm. And just seeing the harm that was going on to these patients, that was what started to make me wake up and realize that I need to kind of speak out and at least balance the narrative with some of the harms that are happening from these lockdowns.
During the second wave, and I can concur with what was already said when the pandemic started. I mean, all of us were very scared. We were very concerned. We were following public health guidelines with regards to, you know, avoiding patient contact unless absolutely necessary. We're trying our best to manage our practices as best we could. But somewhere along the way, I was speaking to a colleague who works at a local hospital, and I was asking him, because the hospitals would send us these forms that if there's a huge wave of patients that are sick or a staff that's sick, are you able to help us in different areas of the hospital? So we had received this and filled it out, and I was trying to figure out what can I help with, emergency, pediatrics, adult medicine. And we never got called. And I called a colleague who works at the hospital, and I asked, I said, so what's going on at the hospital? Are the beds full? Are we close to, being called in? And he said, half the beds are empty. Right? So at the time we started talking about this, we were talking about what is protecting the population. So I was thinking about Brampton, where I practice, where we have a huge minority population, about 73 to 75% are minorities, visible minorities. And we started theorizing maybe it's because people are coming from elsewhere. Maybe they have been vaccinated before, for example. Maybe tuberculosis is often people get vaccinated for tuberculosis in other countries. So maybe that's protecting people. We didn't know. We kept trying to figure out why are the numbers not rising as high as we expected, right? Compared to other countries like Italy and New York and so on and so forth. And so we knew that there were deaths, absolutely. People were passing from COVID. But the numbers didn't make sense to me, especially compared to other parts of the world, because people were saying Toronto is going to be a huge rise here because it's an urban city and so on and so forth. But it didn't happen. And so then after the summer, there was information about seasonality of the virus, vitamin D deficiency, and a lot of people that were in ICUs and passing away. I was looking for that pattern and also looking at the other literature that was coming out, other data. So it was at that time I'm thinking, this doesn't add up, especially when they started talking about locking down again. And that to me didn't make any sense at all, because again, we knew the effects of the first lockdown. Where was the proof that the numbers were going up significantly enough that a lockdown would work? Because it was also shown lockdowns don't work either.
Initially, just like the rest of my colleagues, there was a lot of fear, a fear of the unknown, a fear of the mortality that might come with this virus, a fear of of the transmission of this virus, there was a lot of unknown initially. And I had initially supported a very short lockdown simply because of the unknowns. But then I started to read the peer-reviewed data that was coming out in published medical and scientific literature, and that was coming out of other countries, including other jurisdictions that had not done a lockdown, such as South Dakota, such as Belarus, such as Sweden. And they still had the same curve pattern that we did without a lockdown. They did not have increased mortality above their all-cause mortality, despite not having a lockdown. I then started to compare through the literature the response of the various countries, and then I started to read the heartbreaking reports of the harms that were being caused by the lockdowns, the harms that the Western world's lockdowns were having, not only on the citizens within the Western world, but within the citizens of the developing world. Mm-hmm. And that was heartbreaking to read. And I wasn't seeing any of that being covered in our Canadian media. I wasn't seeing any of that being talked about by my colleagues. I was originally born in India, and I immigrated as a baby with my family to Canada for better opportunities. I was born in a small little village in Enam, India, and the very people being impacted by our lockdowns were people that came from such villages. And the UN reports were saying that 10,000 children were dying in the developing world due to starvation because of the developed world's lockdowns. The UN reports were saying that 150 million people will succumb to poverty and death, and decades of advancement to pull people out of poverty were all being undone because of the developed world's lockdowns, because of our lockdowns, cutting off supply chains. So there were all these harms, all these innocent children that were starving and dying, all these innocent people in the developing world that were facing consequences from our actions. And yet most of my colleagues weren't even conscious of this. And then more data started coming out about the impacts and the harms that were happening locally within Ontario, and then also nationally, where we were seeing a significant rise in suicides. We were seeing a significant rise in addiction overdose deaths. We had oncologists warning of a tsunami of cancers coming over the next decade because most people were missing their cancer screenings. There were warnings of increased deaths of TB happening due to lack of immunizations. There were reports of increased childhood illnesses happening that would normally be prevented by routine childhood immunizations because those children weren't showing up for their regular immunization appointments. There were concerns about sequelae from chronic disease such as heart disease and diabetes because people weren't showing up to the ER because of chest pain, because they were too afraid. And so the basic concept of public health is to look at all harms. And yet, despite all the new data that was coming out, months and months of peer-reviewed data, none of this was being put forth by our governments in terms of the policies. The policies weren't changing. The policies were still stuck with the subjective modeling that was done back in March. And what I found shocking is that going forward into the spring, into the summer, into the fall, our government still kept using subjective modeling when we already had at that point 10 months of hard real life data that was objective to be able to make informed evidence-based decisions on, and that wasn't happening. So that's where I became concerned, and I felt that we needed to have a broader conversation about all harms and about the impacts that our actions were having, not only within the Canadian population, but the harms that we were causing within the developing world due to our actions. Because the very first premise of the practice of our profession is to first do no harm. Mm. So I thought that our actions were causing harm, and I felt that we needed to really pause and to evaluate what we were doing.
So you all came to this conclusion that the harm that is being done is far more significant than the risks that we are, the messaging of the risk that we are getting from public health. In what forums did you raise your concerns, and how was the reaction? So I'm going to ask you first, Dr. Phillips, about mm-hmm. how you went about sharing your concerns.
I only started to speak out publicly, relatively recently, maybe starting in December, the medium that I chose was Twitter, just because I started to watch, just kind of seeing public reactions, seeing other figures on there who are speaking out, like Dr. Gill, and I have to admit, like, I was thinking about speaking out earlier, but it's pretty scary in the medical profession to start questioning the official narrative, especially when everybody seems to be on board with it. By starting to question, I chose Twitter, and then I started to reach out to some others who offered to do interviews for me. So like with Bright Light News Media, I've done some interviews with them and other figures that I have just kind of built a network through Twitter. Through the course of that, also spoken to my physician group. So I've sent out emails and position papers to the CEO of my hospital and to the local physicians as well, just so they weren't caught off guard when they saw that I'm speaking out publicly. And of the people who've responded to me, it's mostly been supportive. But I've heard from a lot of physicians that they know that there can be consequences, so they're not comfortable speaking publicly, but they do support what I'm some of the things that I'm speaking publicly about.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the consequences. First of all, how are physicians coming to this conclusion that there is a consequence for expressing a thought related to their expertise and their profession? Can you talk a little bit about that, perhaps, Dr. Lamba?
What I would say is, in our profession, we are very good at following the rules and thinking about the best for everybody, especially our patients. We all took the Hippocratic Oath. Again, it was already mentioned, the first is to do no harm. But also in our profession, we do, the way that we're trained as a group, we're trained to think a certain way, we are taught to look at evidence-based practice. But we also trust each other a lot. We're in a profession where there's a high stakes when it comes to our patient care and patient lives. And we do trust each other for that reason. If I'm assisting with a surgery and something goes wrong and the surgeon tells me something goes wrong, I'm going to trust them and I'm going to do what they say. You know, you're very dependent on each other to help each other. And I think that when we hear other doctors say certain things, we tend to believe them, and depending on what their positions are. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to kind of go your own way if you don't completely agree with a colleague. There can be consequences for not going with the narrative, so to speak. We work for, even though we are independently licensed, we do work for companies, we work for hospitals, we are associated with many different organizations that can potentially affect how we work.
Okay, so in the COVID context, how would you describe that working environment or that climate?
It's very, as time goes on, I feel like it's more splintered. At the same time, I also feel like the vast majority is seeing through or seeing the data that's coming in. And it's the policy and what we're seeing in terms of evidence-based data, they're not jiving at all. And again, what Dr. Gill had referred to in terms of looking at peer-reviewed articles and the data that's come out. I mean, it's been almost more than a year since we've known about COVID. Those policies or that data is not being applied to policy. It's very obvious at this point. And there's still many doctors who still believe that the policies which were originally started, so to speak, in March or April, they haven't changed much. There's a lot of people that still believe that those policies should still be in place. And the doctors that are trying to be more, trying to get the new data out there and trying to base the policies on that data, there's a lot of pushback.
And you can tell us about that pushback.
So I find that if you're willing to go with the narrative, with the media narrative, if you are calling for more draconian measures, like we've had colleagues call for martial law, we have had colleagues call for full lockdowns, zero COVID, etc. And it seems like the more draconian policies you advocate for, the more mainstream media coverage that you get. And there isn't public pushback to that. However, if you start pointing out the fact that it's not the virus that's unprecedented, but it's our response that's unprecedented, that a lockdown has never on such a large scale ever happened before in our history, that the Canadian and the World Health Organization's pandemic responses up until even 2019 never included a lockdown, that this is completely unprecedented. If you start mentioning things like that, there is significant pushback. If you even cite peer-reviewed literature showing studies published in, say, The Lancet, for example, that showed that the lockdowns do not reduce mortality, and you start citing other peer-reviewed literature that shows that over the next decade and two, we'll actually likely see significant increase in deaths due to all of the other non-COVID related chronic diseases that we're presently ignoring. Even the American Pediatric Society has warned of a generation that will be lost to illness due to significant anxiety, depression, educational harms seen within young children. So we're seeing all of that, but if you bring forward this, you're labeled a conspiracy theorist, despite even citing peer-reviewed literature. If it goes against a dogma that's presented by the mainstream media, which is very fear-driven, there's an unwillingness to actually engage in debate. I've been trying since May to get colleagues to simply discuss all harms. I've been trying to have colleagues engage in debate about the impacts that the lockdowns are having within communities that do not have the privilege of our profession. So we know that the lockdowns harm immigrant communities. We know that they harm people of color. We know that they harm the working class. We know that they harm the poor. We know that they harm people within the developing world. And it seems that within our profession, there's a significant disconnect. And there's an unwillingness to even engage in that debate, and there seems to be anger, even animosity, if you bring forward those concerns, which I find shocking, because we're supposed to be advocating for those that don't have a voice. We're supposed to be advocating for those that are vulnerable. Where I practice in Brampton, as Dr. Lamba mentioned, it's nearly 75% people of color. And it's mostly immigrant, working class people, where oftentimes English isn't the first language. So how are a couple, a family where both of the parents work, supposed to be homeschooling through virtual schooling their child when their first language isn't English? Right. And so there's all of this happening, and there's significant pushback. If you go against the dogma of the lockdowns, you're labeled as not only being a conspiracy theorist, but as being dangerous, mm-hmm. Wanting to, people to die, which is the complete opposite of what you're actually advocating for.
So talk to me about some of the reprisals that you've personally have faced, like some of the sanctions that you've experienced as a result of speaking what you know to be true and well-researched mm-hmm. and grounded in evidence. What has been the reaction?
It's been shocking. Tremendous, unlike anything that I've ever experienced before. So in April, I read a peer-reviewed publication by Dr. Harvey Riesch, who's a Yale professor of epidemiology and in public health, where he had reviewed the data on early outpatient treatment of an HCQ treatment for high-risk patients. And after reading that publication, I then started to read additional publications, and I found, which I was ignorant to before, is that many governments had already adopted early outpatient treatment for the high-risk patients, and many of these countries actually had lower mortality rates compared to Canada. So as I started to share more of these peer-reviewed publications and started to read the data, what I didn't understand is why we weren't simply having an open debate about this. Because patients that could potentially benefit from this treatment were being denied that choice. And so when I started to advocate for us to be able to have this debate, there was tremendous pushback. I was called an anti-vaxxer. I was called a conspiracy theorist. I was called a dangerous person by fellow colleagues, by people that were hyper-partisan. They had politicized these issues. So a lot of medicine and science during this pandemic has become politicized, where people have taken certain positions not based on the peer-reviewed literature, but based on what they think aligns with their political party.
So I see the two of you shaking your head in agreement. So what would you say in your own personal experience?
Well, it was amazing because we're just talking about literally just having a discussion. We're not saying we're right or you're wrong, or that's not what we're saying at all. Mm-hmm. Well, we just want to have a discussion about potentially what is the best way to go with regards to, as Dr. Gill had mentioned, treatment or with regards to the lockdown, anything. And it was amazing because as soon as you might have mentioned maybe there are early outpatient treatments that might be useful, mm-hmm. you were labeled as like, oh, you support Trump.
Wow.
And I couldn't get over that. I'm like, what does this have to do with Trump?
Right.
It was so hyper-polarized. Yeah. It was unbelievable.
I can speak to that even from the other side, because like from in the very beginning, we had almost no COVID cases despite being locked down in Northern Ontario, and the evidence was developing so rapidly that I just kind of eventually tuned it out, and I figured, okay, I'm going to look into this when the second wave comes, and so I'll be up to date on the literature. So I can attest, like, I got most of my information around these things from the media, and I remember hearing about Trump recommending hydroxychloroquine and how that was so dangerous and it was killing people, and some of that was based off just the media, and like also a Lancet publication that was withdrawn 2 weeks later because it was fraudulent, but that caught on in the medical community, and even the idea of even suggesting that we prescribe hydroxychloroquine for this was just unthinkable, and I kind of believed that. And I have to say, I was shocked when I looked at the actual data of meta-analysis of study after study showing that it's effective as an early outpatient treatment. And that was one of those another thing that just kind of threw me back, being like, what's going on here? Because I have to say, I bought into that, and any medical colleagues that I talked to, the same thing happened, where we got a lot of our information from the media. We're human beings like everybody else, and unless you're going to really delve into a topic, we kind of absorb a lot of our medical knowledge from colleagues or And it has been, I'd say, tainted and influenced by media.
Did you ever feel that you had to stop talking about it, or did you feel even more compelled to talk about this after you did your own independent research?
I have to say, like, at that point, I had already decided, after seeing all the harms that were coming into my emergency department, I mentioned the cancers as just one of them, but but the suicidal children, that I was seeing in record numbers, people coming in with just dental infections every day, major, something that could have been fixed easily. They had facial cellulitis. I've seen some with infections that spread to their throat and can block off their airway. Like, things that were pre-penicillin, type of diseases that were coming in because of the fear of coming in to emerge. Because everybody that I talked to is convinced that they're going to catch COVID if they came in there, and they might die from that. And so at that point, at least, I knew I needed to speak out on the lockdowns anyway. And so the more I delved into it, I felt like people need to be aware of this, that there's other options, there's treatments, there's so much research that is not being talked about, and not just one paper, right? This is paper after paper of study after study, and the meta-analysis, which is the compilation of the data, supports so many things like vitamin D, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine as early outpatient treatment, and I was just shocked that it wasn't being even talked about.
So in a health crisis, right, the people who are responsible for making policy decisions with respect to healthcare, like the public health officials, they would stand to benefit from hearing these voices. Is it because they already have read all this and they've decided to just dispense with it? Or do you think there's something else going on? Why is it that you haven't been consulted? Or because you belong to an organization that represents quite a number of physicians. So you would be one of those groups that are engaged in and very interested in this topic, and definitely have a lot to offer.
I don't think any frontline physician has actually been consulted. Very early on, Concerned Ontario Doctors had actually written an open letter way back in April. Yeah. We then did a follow-up letter back in May. At that time, a lot of the things we were advocating for were simple things like PPE, etc., but it had mentioned many of the other aspects as well about the overall response, and there was no response back from the provincial government. Most of the voices that we hear from are from academics, and some of those academics are not necessarily people that are on the front lines or that are speaking in terms of their lived experience or their observed shared experiences. What I find perplexing is during such a pandemic, if we're willing to basically shut down life as we know it, we're willing to shut down schools, we're willing to shut down and make businesses permanently close, we're willing to shut down economies, we're willing to force people not to see their loved ones, we're willing to force people not to have funerals for their loved ones or see their loved ones at their time of death. Why are we not willing to also look at all aspects of health promotion, which is part of healthcare, which is a critical part of public health, is a health promotion. From the peer-reviewed literature, we know that that obesity and that a metabolic disease, such as type 2 diabetes, for example, these are significant risk factors for death amongst COVID patients. But we never ever hear a recommendation surrounding diet, surrounding exercise, surrounding health promotion coming from our public health officials. There is now significant data on vitamin D and vitamin D deficiency being a significant risk factor for people of color over COVID-19, and the data is is quite substantial, which is similar to the data that we also knew from previous viruses, such as influenza, for example, which has a large body of data. And we know that vitamin D is actually essential for our overall immune responses. So in many countries, even the UK, for example, they're supplying free of charge vitamin D for the high-risk populations that are at risk of having a vitamin D deficiency.
So why isn't Canada doing
this? Exactly. And this is something that we have brought up to the public health officials.
And what's the response you get?
There's never a response.
Is there an invitation for consultation on COVID measures in general? Has there ever been any public forum where physicians and physician groups have been invited to comment on policies before they are announced, as we are seeing in press conferences?
No, the exact opposite is happening, where physicians are being scared into self-censorship. Physicians are being scared into not sharing their opinions, into not sharing published data that goes against the political narrative.
So let's talk about where that censorship is coming from. Do you see signs of censorship, and who are the agents of that censorship?
I've had definitely messages from colleagues as well over social media or through emails and things like that where I've been called dangerous. And so that's part of that kind of conformity kind of culture that medicine has, and sometimes that has its benefits too, and mm-hmm. things that if you're actually doing something really dangerous. Mm-hmm. But that's kind of where I've noted it. Like, I only recently began to speak out, so I haven't faced a lot of major institutional pushback or censorship that way.
I feel that the majority of our colleagues are understanding what is happening. But I think there's an enormous amount of fear. And again, because we work, even though we do work in institutions that have the ability to reduce our hours or reduce our ability to get OR time or so on and so forth, right? Mm-hmm. So this is a true threat to our livelihood if we do speak out.
But they've also, I've noted even in my own institution, that the nurses are very aware that the college will go after them if they make social media posts that in any way call into question the public health measures or their opinion on any of the mainstream interventions. So they've been warned, and although I've had many conversations about these harms, because I see these harms every day from these lockdowns, and I talk to the nurses about them, and they're all very aware, but I can tell you that the nurses that I work with are scared of their college because they've made it very clear that they'll go after them.
So let's talk about your complaint. You actually had a formal complaint filed. Mm-hmm. So without getting into the substance of the complaint, can you tell our audience about, you know, what precipitated that and what your reaction was as a result?
So in early August, the federal chief public health officer, Dr. Tam, had indicated during a press conference that we will likely have these lockdowns, these social distancing, masking measures in place well after we even have a vaccine, perhaps for another 1 to 3 years. And so I had tweeted out that it's that we don't need to wait for a vaccine, right? And then there was this entire cancel culture mob that for over a week ran a dehumanizing campaign against me to make me seem like I was some sort of monster that was dangerous to society for my opposition to these harmful lockdowns, for my call to having public debates about early outpatient treatment, for my advocacy against the actual lockdowns, for my call to actually talk about the published data. So when I say truth, I mean we know now that the risk of death varies greatly depending upon age and depending upon overall risk factors, which we didn't know early on. right? But we know that if you're under 70, your chance of survival from the virus is approximately 99.95%. If you're over 70, it's approximately 95%. So for a child, the risk of influenza is actually greater than the risk of SARS-CoV-2, which is the virus that actually causes COVID-19. So these are discussions we're not having. So we're not rationalizing the overall risk. We're not contextualizing the overall risk. We're not looking at the relative risks compared to the harms and the risks of the actions of the lockdowns and the overall sequelae of that. And so there was this monstrous campaign. It was orchestrated, it was organized through certain actors online, and it involved members of the academic profession and also some members of the media and who are very pro lockdown. And they ran a campaign to get people to launch complaints against me. And in all my years of practice, I have never had a patient complaint ever. And
these were not patient complaints.
These were not patient complaints.
These were patients, there was complaints by
these
whom?
These were mostly hyper-partisan people who had no idea of the research of what I was actually talking about and were just going along with the mob mentality of me being dangerous, a conspiracy theorist. How dare I challenge the dogma, right? And it was tormenting. Absolutely tormenting. I got abusive messages to my clinic. My staff were harassed. I was harassed. I was vilified. I was made out to be some sort of monster, right? And it was the nihilistic sort of attitude that has been predominant within North America, where there's this dehumanizing conformity. Right? And so if you don't conform, you must be some sort of monster. And there's a lot of ignorance behind that, right? So rather than engaging in debate, rather than actually challenging what I was saying, countering it with facts, engaging in a professional, respectful debate, they just attacked me as a person. And it was extremely dehumanizing. But I kept speaking out, and I'm still speaking out because this is much greater than me. The whole reason I'm speaking out is because I know people within the communities I practice are being harmed. Fellow Canadians are being harmed. People where I was born are being harmed. People around the world are being harmed, that are marginalized, that don't have a voice, that don't have a platform. And that's something I'm privileged right now to have. And so my voice isn't just my voice right now. My voice is a voice for millions. And I'm willing to put myself in harm's way in terms of the public backlash, because I know deep down in my heart that I'm doing this for all the right reasons. 5 years from now, I'll be able to look myself in the mirror and know that I did everything to try to prevent further harm to society, and know that I was on the right side of history. And that's what our profession teaches us, a core element of being a of actually being a physician is patient advocacy, is advocacy for the community, advocacy for the general population. And if I can't be a voice for them, well then who is going to be a voice for them? They have no voice.
There is a vacuum right now in public health with respect to these voices. It's like they're just glossed over as if they don't exist, right? So I wanted to talk about, why is it that we're not having all the physicians coming out and talking about this? Because this is so compelling. The evidence is so compelling. The research is so well documented. Mm-hmm. So why aren't we petitioning as physicians and physician groups? Why aren't we petitioning our governments to do an about turn, or to at least have a public open debate about such important issues in the health crisis?
So I think as Dr. Gill brought up, I think there's something going on in group psychology in our society right now. And I forget who coined the term, but it's been called a moral panic. Okay. And in a moral panic, something is seen as unthinkable, an unthinkable thing. So a COVID death or a case of COVID in our psychology as a society is seen as an unthinkable thing that could never be justified. And the other side of that coin as well means that everything is justified to bring down COVID numbers. And so under this quasi-compassion for people who might catch COVID, we throw out any evidence in of our minds because it's so unthinkable for somebody to ever catch this disease now. We throw under the bus everybody who's being harmed because it's considered immoral to even think of the harms that could come from trying to save lives from COVID. So in people's minds, it's all about saving lives, right? But only COVID lives. If you want to look at how like scientific debate or medical debate usually works, you can look at our highways, right? So we have deaths every day from motor vehicle accidents. Yeah, all doctors would want to reduce those numbers of deaths, but we would also weigh the other side of that, of people being able to work and go to school and all of those things, and people are able to kind of weigh those risks because we're not in a moral panic over motor vehicle collisions, mm-hmm. right? That's not seen as an unthinkable thing. It's seen as an accepted risk. But because of the fear and the moral panic that's been created around COVID, psychologically, it's just seen as unthinkable to even question mm-hmm. anything that is being done to reduce COVID numbers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're talking about the psychological fear as well mm-hmm. as the college, the college sort of environment that's being created by attacking people who are in leadership roles, such as Dr. Gill. Mm-hmm. What about the you referred to a term called COVID zero. Can you tell us about that a little bit more?
And there's a campaign, and it's happened in many countries to eradicate COVID, right? Mm-hmm. So the idea is we will accept anything and take on the most draconian measures mm-hmm. Possible to get rid of COVID. And I think in their minds that we just haven't locked down hard enough.
What I find perplexing, though, is that advocacy group. So when you look at the peer-reviewed literature, when you look at the data from other countries, for example, Peru had very draconian lockdown measures. They had one of the hardest lockdowns globally that was a military enforced. And they now have one of the highest deaths per capita from COVID-19. So when you look at the data, having a harder lockdown doesn't save lives. And yet the colleges don't consider the COVID zero groups to be dangerous, right? Mm-hmm. So even though they are also going against present public health measures, right? Mm-hmm. The present public health measures are not advocating for COVID zero, mm-hmm. but this advocacy group that is calling for, some of them within that group, as I mentioned, are even calling for martial law, mm-hmm. all these other draconian measures, which we know from experiences of other countries actually lead to more deaths. Mm-hmm. But the colleges don't consider that to be dangerous.
And the other thing is that I just don't understand is just all you have to do is just look at the raw numbers. All you have to do is look at the years before COVID mm-hmm. and look at all-cause mortality. So what all-cause mortality is, how many people have died in the country total, right? Mm-hmm. So statistically, look at last year versus after COVID. Right. Is there a difference? Because also remember, the categorization of deaths, we're not too sure what's going on there either. Right. I mean, I work in long-term care, I work in retirement, I fill out many forms. Remember, pretty much everybody's being swabbed for COVID in any institution, whether it be hospital, long-term care, retirement. And sometimes COVID-19 is going on there because they're positive for COVID or they had symptoms, but that might not have been the reason why they died. But how is the government counting these cases? Yeah. We have no idea. So what we have to do is look at all-cause mortality and look at that number because we actually don't know if they're being categorized correctly. Right? So that's one thing that, you know, that I've been, you know, trying to get out there, that just look at the numbers, just look at the total number. That's all you have to look at, right? And again, anytime there's a medical intervention, you have to weigh the benefit versus the effects of it. Right? And I think all of us sitting on this panel, and again, the silent majority, I believe that it's growing day by day. The harm of the lockdowns way outweighs the harms of COVID. People are going to pass from COVID, absolutely. But again, we all also know that it's seasonal. It's going to come back every year. Mm-hmm. Are we planning on locking down forever? Because COVID is not going to go anywhere. It's endemic. H1N1 didn't go anywhere. Swine flu didn't go anywhere. All of these viruses, the vaccination is in the flu vaccine every year.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
But they want to make COVID separate. When COVID, theoretically, could probably be included in the flu, in the flu virus. We don't really know because nobody's having this discussion.
Right. And as Dr. Lamba mentioned, like that all-cause mortality data is so important to actually look at. So when you look at Sweden, for example, that didn't close down schools, so their schools remained open during the entire pandemic for children under the age of 14. All their daycares remained open. All the businesses remained open. They had no mass lockdown. They had no mandatory masking. They had zero deaths from COVID-19 within children. Mm-hmm. And there was no increased transmission found amongst teachers compared to the average of every other profession. And when you look at the all-cause mortality data for Sweden, it's actually no higher than their all-cause average mortality from the past decade, and it's comparable to actually 2015. And this is a country that didn't do any of the draconian measures that we have done. And yet we're not looking at that data. And then similarly, when you look at data from Health Canada or from Stats Canada in terms of COVID, in terms of all-cause mortality, Canada also hasn't had an increase in all-cause mortality deaths. So we need to start looking at the broader published data that we have rather than continuing to go with these subjective models, which are entirely dependent upon what measures you input. And then start having this broader discussion, which is so crucial.
And one thing I wanted to say about long-term care, because most of the deaths are in long-term care. We can all agree to that. Mm-hmm. Again, we need to look at the numbers. We need to look at previous years. How many people have died and what have they died from? We need to look at, was it a viral illness or what was it? Right? Because that's the only way we're going to know if COVID has actually increased the numbers or not. And as far as we know, they haven't. We haven't seen the data. So if the government could please provide us the raw data, we just want the numbers. And almost any citizen, you don't have to be a doctor, you just have to be able to read and do basic math. We can figure out, has the death rate gone up or not? That's what we need to know. And we want that data, we want to see it.
And has there been a call for this data? What's the response been?
Silence again. Similar in terms of various jurisdictions across the world define a COVID case very differently. So here in Ontario, the definition of a case changed in early August, where we started to even include people who are immune, who have IgG antibodies, as being a COVID case, which is appalling. Like you're considering someone who's immune as being a case. If someone is swabbed multiple times and comes up positive multiple times, they're counted as a new case each time. We know that there's significant limitations to the PCR testing that's being applied, and even the World Health Organization has come out with two statements. One is just recent as a couple of weeks ago, where they have sounded the alarm in terms of possibility of high false positives from high cycle thresholds, where according to the peer-reviewed literature, including some data that was published with co-authorship from the Public Health Agency of Canada, if you have high cycle thresholds, significantly higher than 30, but even higher than 25, you can be a PCR positive case, but not be infectious because you're picking up inactive remnants of the RNA virus. And so here in Ontario, according to the published paper from the Public Health Agency of Canada, Ontario labs are using cycle thresholds varying from about 38 to about 45. Mm-hmm. And now there's more and more peer-reviewed literature coming out showing that it's very unlikely to have a viable infectious virus culturable if you're using a PCR cycle threshold above 25, and definitely if you're using one above 30. Mm-hmm. So we're basing all of these parameters, all these draconian measures where we're taking away basic civil liberties, basic freedoms, fundamental freedoms that don't come from the government. These are our birthrights, and the government's role is to protect them, and they're being taken away based on flawed testing. And we're not even having discussions around that. Mm-hmm. When these questions are raised to government officials, again, there's silence, right? So these are discussions that need to be happening. These are debates that need to be happening. And if we're not going to have them now, when are we going to have them?
In this climate, I don't think the purpose is to have them, if I could just give my opinion, because what I'm hearing from you is that there is a silencing that's happening, and then there's repercussions for those who break that silence, and then there's also a renewed climate of fear that is being propagated. So right now we're being told about a new strain. Mm-hmm. In your opinion, does that change anything you've said about this wealth of information you're describing about the harms of the lockdown? Does that change anything with respect to the new strain?
I'd say it doesn't really. Coronaviruses are known to mutate frequently, and that's we've
it's the nature.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and like the cold virus is the same story, right? It's the reason why they didn't even bother trying to get a vaccine for these mm-hmm. before, because they mutate so often mm-hmm. that it would be mm-hmm. mostly useless. But so the fact that there's mutations was well known before. Mm-hmm. And is not really news. But in particular, the one that they're looking at, the B117, there is evidence that it is more infectious, but slightly. And we don't really know entirely. A lot of this hasn't really panned out in really good, solid studies. And there's no evidence that it's significantly more harmful, because if you look at the evolutionary pressures behind these coronavirus mutations, is they're going to mutate to be able to spread further, right? They like their hosts to be alive, mm-hmm. right? In order to propagate, right? So the longer you can live with it, the less likely, the more likely you are to pass it on. So they tend to become more infectious and less deadly with time.
Right. So until we see the data showing that it's more deadly, which we doubt is going to happen, then there should be no panic. But again, look at the narrative, the media, those players that you've been seeing the whole time, they're the ones that keep propagating the fear. Right. And people need to start looking at the facts.
When you look at the data in many jurisdictions around the world, you may have had an increase in cases, but you're not seeing a correlated increase in deaths. And what Dr. Gupta, who's a prominent epidemiologist from the University of Oxford, had said is what is likely to happen with this virus is that it's likely to become endemic. So it's not likely to go away, but it's likely to just become an endemic, where it becomes just like every other a virus that we just learned to live with. And so the possibility of a zero COVID isn't supported by the data. And it's and such a goal would just lead to destruction of our democratic society, immense harms to the most vulnerable, with the inability to actually get to the goal that they're advocating for. And so we really need to comprehend the life cycle of viruses and to learn to live with COVID-19, because in some jurisdictions around the world, it has already become endemic according to the data, mm-hmm. right? And so we also need to realize that there's more to our immune system than just antibodies. So oftentimes, even in the official government narratives, the immune system response is only talked about in terms of antibodies, but we have T cells. Mm-hmm. And T cells are known to play a very prominent role in terms of the body's ability to fight off not just the SARS-CoV-2 virus, but many other viruses as well. In the peer-reviewed literature, T cells have actually been referred to as the warriors fighting against SARS-CoV-2. And in one peer-reviewed paper, it was argued that potentially by closing schools, by preventing the transmission of the common cold virus amongst children, that may have actually led to more SARS-CoV-2 deaths amongst the vulnerable, because there's a potential that that prevented the cross-protective immunity seen from the common cold virus against SARS-CoV-2. So we need to realize that on a more granular scale, there are other harms that are potentially happening from these lockdowns that we're not recognizing. And so we need to really have a very broad overview of our actions and actually dissect each government intervention from the total harms and the total benefits, as opposed to just going with this media fear narrative. Mm-hmm. Right now, everything's being driven by fear. Mm-hmm. And when we're reacting to fear, we're not rational. Mm-hmm. And so rather than being reactive, we need to start to becoming proactive. Mm-hmm. And start to actually assess the published peer-reviewed literature, the actual data that we now have over the past year, as opposed to these modeling figures. The models just need to be thrown out the window.
And so for the public that's listening to us talk about peer-reviewed articles, it might seem overwhelming, but really at the end of the day, like I'd mentioned before, we just need the all-cause mortality from pre-COVID and now. That's all we need. And all of us can see for ourselves. And all of us need to be proactive, not just academics, not just physicians, all of us. Because if we want to have any say in how our country is going to move forward, we have to become active, actively involved.
Well, that's a great note to end on. Mm-hmm. I want to thank you all for joining us today and for all the important work that you're doing to inform the public and also to stand up for your own beliefs and your thoughts and your expressions. Thank you.